You're listening to Well Made, a podcast from Lumi about the people and ideas behind your favorite online brands. I'm your host, Stefan Ango. Hillary Milnes, welcome to the show.
Hi, Stefan. Thanks for having me.
So, Hillary, you are the managing editor at Glossy. Tell me a little bit about Glossy. I think it's a publication that and a podcast that a lot of our fans would enjoy.
Yeah, thank you. So yes, I am the managing editor at Glossy. I also host the Glossy podcast. We're an online publication covering the intersection of digital technology, luxury, fashion, and beauty, basically trying to make sense of how businesses in that space are evolving with the times, disrupting other brands that are that have been in the space for a while. And it's really, you know, we want to be the go-to resource for people in that industry, people who work outside that industry, and to understand basically what it means to be a modern brand today and how to reach today's customers. And on the Glossy podcast, we interview industry leaders from brands on the fashion and beauty sides who are kind of at the forefront of that change to talk about their personal strategies, their outlooks on the future of retail and luxury in general, and anything else that they see going on.
So a lot of good overlap with what we're doing, but I think you cover a little bit more of the physical retail side. So I'm excited to talk a little bit about that. What's the balance between the digital versus physical of Glossy?
We approach it digital first, but I think more and more we've been realizing just how much the store is being caught up in that evolution. So, you know, anything that a brand does in store, it should be because they're sort of evolving with their digital strategy. So whether that's a direct-to-consumer brand that's now realizing that they should be trying pop-ups or opening up a few different permanent physical stores, which, you know, we've been covering more and more just how much everyone is realizing that that has to be part of the strategy. Or if it's a brand that's really merging their digital and physical inventories, anything that's done today is kind of done with that digital lens. How do we make the most of our customer data? How do we make our inventory strategies align just to make sure that the customer experience is on par with what people expect today? I think that people are realizing the customer doesn't think in, okay, now I'm in the store, and that's its own separate customer journey or path to purchase. It's all one thing to the customer, and brands haven't really had to think that way in the past. So looking at any way that the store comes into the lens with how does it have to evolve and act differently and be a different part of the customer experience than it was before. It used to be much more simple. You go into a store and if you buy something, if you like it, and that's kind of that. But, you know, I think we know that it's all over the place today. And so brands are dealing with that on multiple fronts, depending on where they're coming from a store experience. And so, you know, I think I've heard a million times from people like, okay, well, now we know, like, retail's not dead. It's just changing. And so figuring out what that looks like from multiple perspectives is kind of the approach that we're taking.
Yeah, so in recent episodes, we've been talking about this meta narrative with Lauren Sherman, who came on to talk a little bit about how, you know, sort of more physical retailers are going into the DTC space, and how with Webb Smith on a recent episode, how much the digital native brands are trying to experiment with physical retail. One reason being that it's become so expensive to advertise online through Facebook and other platforms. You wrote a story recently about that kind of stuff. You wrote that story titled, Can't Forget to Sell the Product, that e-commerce brands are struggling to bring stories to life in store. Can you walk us through a little bit of what you're seeing there?
Yeah, so I think the cost of customer acquisition is a really important ongoing story for us, because we're getting to that point where you can now look at a new direct-to-consumer, modern, trendy brand. They have the brand story, they have the modern marketing, they are everywhere that you see on social media, they have ads in the subway, and it's because they're backed by so much VC funding. And now I think the narrative is more coming to light that you can buy customers once and it's going to be expensive, but your sales will skyrocket to, like, you know, 10,000, 100,000 in revenue. But at that point, you're then going to have to buy the customers again, and then it's going to be even more expensive, and it's just not sustainable. And so I think the new or the current or the next generation of the direct to consumer modern brands are realizing that it may not be the best story in the press, but if you're growing sustainably and having a lot of repeat customers, repeat purchasers, that's a lot more healthy business model than saying like, oh, we have Facebook ads everywhere. We bought this customer once, because that's just going to be, you know, it's not a sustainable way to grow a business. And so I think where the store comes into play there, both on the pop-up side and the permanent side, is yes, it costs a lot of money. It's a down payment, but you can make that money back and have a profitable channel. And then people are not only walking away with potentially a purchase, but also that tangible brand impression. You know, they might be able to experience the brand better. And in that story in particular, we talked to a few different brand founders about how you make sure that when people do come into the store, it's the same lasting impression that they might get if they are looking at the brand through their Instagram feed or online or through videos. You can really just put so much content into your online web brand experience that, you know, if someone comes into the store and they see a messy pile of clothes and, okay, yeah, it's like decorated kind of nice, but there's a lot of people in there. You might get a bad experience, because at the end of the day, retail is still four physical walls and a checkout system. Like, how do you really reinvent the wheel there? You can't. So how do you take this perfectly curated, really aesthetically driven web experience that the customer has when they interact with the brand online and translate that into the store? So not only can they buy something, but they can walk away knowing what the brand is all about. I think there's a trickiness there that the brands are kind of figuring out. And it was actually inspired by the new Everlane store that opened in Soho or NoHo. It's close by our office. But you tour the store from the press end and see all of the really nice details and you know, very modern, experiential driven pieces that they put in there to say, okay, this is what Everlane is all about in a store format. It's the brand that you know and love online, and now you can really experience it in person. You can put on headphones and listen to the sounds of the factory where these jeans were made, which is really nice in theory, but when there's a line out the door and, you know, the entire store is just overwhelmed by customers and the fitting rooms are a mess, like, that kind of all falls apart. Obviously, it's a good thing because there are actual people in the store, but it's almost like that pristine experience that brands have gotten used to when they were building online. It's kind of like, oh yeah, wait, retail is kind of a mess for a reason. And I think it's kind of realizing, like, okay, this is why you walk into Macy's and the floor is a mess. It's not because that they don't care. It's just that it's really hard to reinvent that physical experience. And so I think there's some interesting ongoing tension there as brands are figuring that out.
I think in the beginning, when a lot of these digital brands went and started their retail stores, they were very experimental with it. There was a lot of these pop-up shops or like no inventory stores where it's basically a showroom. But I'm seeing more and more that some of the brands are really taking it more the traditional route and actually having inventory there of all the different styles. Is that something that I'm just sort of anecdotally seeing, or are you noticing that too?
No, I think there's definitely been some pushback on the showroom model, because, you know, why have a store? People want to a lot of times walk away with something that they can buy. I think I spoke to, for that story, the founders of the fine jewelry brand Aurait, and they said that they were initially planning to have a showroom model. You could just look at the pieces, try them on. Obviously, it's a big purchase. It's not inexpensive jewelry, and so they knew that people wanted to get to know the brand in person. And so their first in-store retail experience was like right across the street from their offices. And so people kept coming in and wanting to buy right then and there. They had to run up and down the stairs and just grab inventory that they had laying around the office and sell it through the store. And so that's when it was kind of like, okay, this might work for some people, but it doesn't work for us. I think that it does create, it's nice in theory because, one, you don't have inventory overhead. That's easier. Two, people want the convenience of not having bags burdening them, but it really, I think, does create a level of friction. And so I think the store is just becoming the store and not so much a showroom, unless you're someone like Casper, where you can't really walk out with the bed anyway. Maybe you can, I think you can buy like a pillow or a blanket as they're expanding in stores there, but for the most part, I think people still want to shop in stores the same way that they always have. And so brands are sort of giving into that.
If I were to put my investor hat on, I feel like I'd be asking at this point, how is this different than maybe what like Lululemon did X number of years ago? I feel like we're giving these digital brands a lot of credit for, you know, approaching the concept of retail in a different way. But if it's not really that different, if it's really just a new path to building a lot of stores, what is the difference?
Right. I think that's a great question. I think overall investors are kind of getting wise to this space, at least when it comes to apparel, that, you know, it's not ever going to scale like a tech company. And so that's, I think, changed the balance between the investors and these brands. A lot of them are saying they might do an angel round of family and friends, but having that investor hat, that mindset looming overhead, it kind of can do more of a disservice than good. But assuming that they do have a fair amount of investor money, I think that what they can say is, well, what we can do is figure out where it makes sense to open stores because we have this history of customer data and we know where people are more likely to shop in stores. And you know, the more, and if we have a store in that area and we can prove out that over time it costs us less to acquire customers in that area because we have the store, then there we go. That's a profitable business. Whereas before, it's, you know, if you're Lululemon, you know where you need a store because that's where stores have always been. It's a popular shopping area, but you don't have that data as evidence to prove out that you have a loyal customer here already. And so I think that the plotting of the store fleet is going to get a lot smarter, you know, rather than just let's build a bunch of stores and people will shop there, we hope or we believe. That, I think, is an interesting point, as well as just we can get people to come to the store because they know us online. It's not that we open a store and we have to then go out and prove who we are, draw people in somehow. It's just, you know, this new brand on the block. You know, I think the sheer fact that Everlane opened a store and has a line out the door because people recognize the brand from knowing them online and shopping them online and want to now see it in person. Same with a Glossier, that I think proves that they're doing something differently. I don't think we really saw that before.
Yeah, and I think it's interesting to see which brands are having success with their retail experiments. And I think the ones that are having success are the ones that have enough of a diverse product line that they can fill out a store. When you think about the broad range of vertical commerce brands that are emerging, a lot of them are super focused. They're making, you know, socks or toothbrushes or, you know, something, and they're attacking that market in a very precise way. And it's hard for me to imagine, let's say, you know, a toothbrush store. And so now, for that brand who has to compete in these like advertising markets where the spend is getting higher and higher, I wonder what the solution for them is. I know there's a few retail experiments that are popping up where it's multi-brand retail. What are you seeing on that side?
Yeah, I think the future of in-store multi-brand retail is going to be really interesting because we've seen how much department stores have struggled to create a compelling experience. I think people, younger customers in general, are really turned off by that really sprawled. It's messy. It's overwhelming. It's not personalized whatsoever. That I think is going to have to change. And so it's interesting to see what, you know, multi-brand retailers online have done and as they contemplate how they want to navigate the physical retail experience. Obviously, Farfetch is experimenting with the store of the future on behalf of its Browns business that it acquired. I think Essence may opened a store in Canada where you can make an appointment and that's where you can have your fitting room stocked with what you tried on, based on how you've been shopping online. So it's appointment driven. It's connecting the online and offline shopping experiences, and they're bringing in brands for pop-ups and shop-in-shops and events and things like that. So I think that's an interesting way of doing it down the line. But in terms of, yeah, like having, you can't build a store around toothbrushes. You probably would be better off like in a Sephora or finding a physical retail store that already exists that aligns with the brand. I think, you know, you're just mentioning the safe space retailers for direct-to-consumer brands like a Nordstrom, a Sephora, brands that you know or retailers that you know aren't kind of the pitfalls that traditional department stores have run into, like you know, too many promotion cycles and just unsavory experiences overall. But I think that's why we've seen a lot of these brands expanding to different categories in general. Like when Glossier started, I think that it was one set of skincare products, and now they started going into cosmetics, and now that just keeps multiplying. And I think it really calls into question or requires a lot of critical analysis around what they can actually do well, because when you put so much focus on branding and not so much on product, that can really show to the customer who might buy into the brand and then realize, oh, wait a second, like this product actually isn't that great. Like, what am I really paying for the quote unquote luxury product without the markup? So I think it's interesting to see how these brands do expand, because I think a big part of their strength is that they can do a few things really well. And if you kind of succumb to the pressures of just selling more in order to make more money, that's where it can really start to fall apart.
Yeah, I mean, so many of the brands have made a part of their pitch to customers that it's, you know, they're cutting out the middleman, and therefore, you know, they can provide a product at a better price. And obviously, if they're seeking more growth and they're trying to bring their products to retail, that equation is going to get squeezed. And, you know, I'm wondering if that's something that the customers care about, if that's something that brands care about. That narrative seems to like be difficult to maintain.
Yeah, I do. I always wonder like what the customer, like the brand fans think, like how much they know it has to go on behind the scenes of these brands, or just how much trust is there in general. Like, and you put on your kind of take a step back, okay, what if I didn't think about retail all day long? Like, what would I notice? What would stand out? And I sometimes talk to friends that are just overhear them saying things like, oh, I saw that brand on Facebook. Like, oh, that brand's all over my Facebook ads. It's all over my Instagram ads. And so I don't know. It's where that comes, like that customer perception comes in. I think there are certain customers who understand, like, oh, by buying into this brand, I'm supporting like basically what is the new generation of brands. And I understand that when I am buying into a new brand, there might be some bumps along the way. I think that plays a big role in especially brands that are really promoting their sustainable sides. That's kind of where the transparency as a marketing term came along, because it was kind of asking customers to bear with them as they figured out how to be more sustainable. So I think that overall, if you are a customer that is supporting a brand because you believe in what it's doing in general, and you know that it's still figuring things out because it hasn't been around for a long time, I think that customers are willing to go along with that more than they are willing to have a bad experience with a brand that's been around forever. I think there's kind of a level of understanding that this is a new brand and it might not be perfect, but at the same time, I think patience is going worth it, because at the end of the day, it's, you know, there's so much competition, you can always be spending your money somewhere else.
Yeah. In general, we're hearing a lot about the retail apocalypse and the malls closing and a lot of the department stores having a hard time transitioning. You mentioned Nordstrom, Sephora. It sounds like they're managing the transition a little better than others. What are you seeing there?
Yeah, I think, and I haven't done this story yet, but I'm really interested in doing it, is just how Nordstrom is getting these direct-to-consumer brands, like Reformation is the latest one. Everlane sold through there before. You know, how do you look like a attractive partner today? I think, and then that's where Amazon comes in as well. Like, these brands are really consumed by the company that they keep. And so if you are selling through channels where you can't control your brand story and your pricing and your value proposition to customers, it revolves on those things, that it's so story driven and marketing heavy, that if you're going to be selling through a channel where that gets lost, where a lot of, you know, traditionally it really has in the past, it's a much bigger risk to take. But at the same time, you know, it's about growth and exposure and making money at the end of the day. So picking and choosing really wisely is what's going to be critical going forward. And I think that's why Nordstrom, like, because when, you know, when you think about stores that have closed a bunch of locations, Nordstrom has kind of been able to stay above that narrative. Obviously, Sephora is a brand that people love in its own right. And so if you are a beauty brand in the cosmetic side, skincare, that's, I think, going to be an attractive partner, although it's interesting watching Sephora and Ulta kind of duke it out there to get to get different exclusive lines and brands and stores. But I think overall, what the interesting thing that department stores have on their sides is this ability to be the anti-Amazon partner. I think going forward, if they can really show brands that they are not going to sacrifice their brand story, let them tell it on their own, really build an attractive place online, and maybe follow more of the curated shop and shop model in stores, start out with a few physical locations that are working really well and align with that customer, there's going to be a big opportunity to kind of arm themselves on both the retailer and the brand side against Amazon, because Amazon is not in a place where they need to do that. They're just going to focus on the customer experience at the end of the day. So I think there is a great opportunity for more traditional department stores that have been struggling to sort of position themselves as allies to these new brands that are so connected to the customer, because I think that'll pay off in a few ways on both ends.
Yeah, the implicit thing that you're mentioning about Amazon is just that just having control over your pricing, having control over the way that your product is marketed is something that, for whatever reason, Amazon has never prioritized with the brands that sell on the platform. I think Nike probably is like the big story around that, and it would be interesting to hear. I don't know if you're seeing what has happened actually since they became a partner on Amazon, I think like a year ago or so. Is that working? Because part of the reason that they wanted to do this was to curb the number of third-party sellers and like the chaos that is Amazon if you search for Nike. It's a very chaotic thing, and weirdly, you would think that this would make Amazon seem worse as a partner, but it actually gives them a ton of leverage over brands to come and work with them. Whenever I see this, I'm like, it worries me for every brand that tries to partner with Amazon. It's such a deal with the devil.
Oh, absolutely. I think the Nike case study is a really fascinating one, which I haven't looked into it in a few months, but we did do a story using some data from L2, that the digital research firm, around what happened in the few months after Nike became a first-party seller on Amazon. And, you know, Nike is probably one of the most, not even probably, it's one of the most recognizable brands in the entire world. They have such a powerful brand cachet, and you would think on one hand that, okay, if they're going to shake hands with Amazon and go all in, that Amazon would want to prioritize that relationship. But no, I think what happened was they proved that what they prioritize is the customer relationship and that experience, because when you're on Amazon, even when you are Nike, people aren't necessarily looking by brand. They're typing in running shorts and Nike shorts come up, and the customer doesn't care who's selling it. It's whether it's a third party seller or Nike itself. What they're looking for is reviews and proof from other customers that I bought this item. It was legit. It was good. And that history of having reviews come up in search, that's favored by Amazon over just that Nike brand cachet. And so I think that looking at that scenario where Nike selling first and foremost on the platform, they weren't able in the first few months to take sales away from those third-party sellers because they didn't have the historical customer review and data and search history that they needed in order to be prioritized by the way Amazon promotes and shows different items to customers. I think there's even an example of a Nike t-shirt that was, you know, the Amazon choice, which I think influences a lot of people's purchases on Amazon, that kind of like trust signifier, like this is a good purchase to make. They put the Amazon choice label on a third-party seller item and not one that's being sold directly by Nike. So I think that's a really big red flag for a lot of brands, especially when you get more into luxury or contemporary luxury fashion. There's a lot of brands that have big problems with third-party sellers, the, you know, gray market sellers on Amazon. But, you know, what can you do with that from a distance, especially if it goes to show that even if like selling on it yourself isn't the answer, like just being like, okay, finally, okay, I'm here, I've given in, like that doesn't, Amazon's not going to bend over backwards for you just because you came around and decided to sell on their platform. They want what's going to most likely result in a purchase. And if you have a Tory Burch dress that has a ton of reviews. It's a lot of customer photos, great history of purchase and search. That's going to come up more than a Tory Burch dress that's sold by Tory Burch, but has absolutely no reviews. Because I think that says a lot about how people shop on it on Amazon, and it's not brand first.
Yeah, I have so many conflicted feelings about Amazon because I shop there all the time. I'm in awe of how they've been able to build that company. You know, I use on at Lumi, we use Amazon Web Services for a lot of our back end. Like, there's all these different things where we're sort of tied into that ecosystem, but they have so many ways of stabbing you in the back as a brand. Like, they're doing all of this stuff with launching new private label brands every day. It seems like they probably, I don't know how many they have now, but it's something like 50 or 60 different private label brands.
So I think it's like six, yeah, between, I don't even want to say because I'm sure it's outdated, but I think it's 60 some alone on the apparel side.
And they're positioning them right next to, you know, hey, you like this shirt? Buy this Amazon, you know, Basics one, or a name that is not even clearly an Amazon product, but actually is owned by Amazon. It's super confusing, and they somehow seem to thrive off of that chaos. You've been writing a newsletter about Amazon. Like, what have been those different narratives you've been thinking about or writing about lately?
Yeah, it's kind of funny because in wanting to show multiple perspectives, it feels like one week I might be like, Amazon is killing brands. Another week it's like, oh, actually, Amazon might be an okay partner for brands if you look at it this way. So just wanting to show different perspectives on what's happening there. So if you look at it from the private label perspective, there are a lot of brands that might say, why would I want to sell on Amazon when all they're going to be able to do is understand my customer data better than I can myself, because they're not sharing any like remarkable amounts of data with me as a brand. And then they're going to be able to make a better product for slightly cheaper and promote it better on their own algorithm. And I think we've seen that happen to categories like diapers and batteries. And I think that, you know, in fashion though, there's still a level of, you know, how can you navigate this? Because you're not, it's not a pure commodity. Maybe if you're Hanes and it's a white t-shirt, that's a little bit different. But talking about, you know, more trend-driven fashion, which as we know, Amazon hasn't really nailed. I wonder what's going on, because I know that they came out in Europe with that brand. I think it was called Find, and it was looked exactly like you were looking at Zara. But other than that, I think it's been very, you know, maybe slightly trendy, but more for like working women or athletic wear. So I think if you're a brand and you're kind of on the outskirts and saying, okay, if I go and sell on Amazon, are they just going to rip my styles, sell it for cheaper, and I'm going to get lost in the algorithm, and you know, it's a lose-lose? Or I think you can also look at it in the way that as Amazon's going into private label fashion, people are going to start to think, okay, this, you know, Amazon is becoming more of a destination for fashion. And so that could lift the entire category overall. And if you are confident in your, you know, able to design trends, like Amazon's algorithm shouldn't be able to grip that so easily. You know, I think that if you just go by data alone, it's, you're going to end up with carbon copies of the same styles and trends. And I don't think Amazon's proven that its algorithm, it can really make a fashion brand yet. So I think, and there was someone I spoke to, I should be able to quote them properly, but this was in one of the newsletters. Someone said, like, you know, I'm sure there was a time when people went into Costco and saw a rack of jeans and were like, jeans, why would I buy them at Costco? But then they eventually got used to seeing them there. And now, you know, Costco sells its own private label. It's not fashion, but it's clothing. And so I think that it's almost building consumer behavior overall. And if you are a strong enough brand to be able to get in on the Amazon platform, I think Calvin Klein's a good example of what they've done on the underwear side, especially because underwear is, you know, it's a basic purchase. But if you are someone who's going with the intent of buying a Calvin Klein bra and you want it to say Calvin Klein, there's likely not going to be an Amazon product that can replace that intent and undermine that purchase. And so I think the smartest thing for brands to do, and like you said, I'm also conflicted because I also shop on Amazon all the time. And then I, like, by day I'm writing about how Amazon is killing all these brands. So equally conflicted, but I think the smartest thing to do is just really figure out a strong tiering of product so that if you are shopping, so your brand can have a presence for a certain category on Amazon, like Calvin Klein underwear, but nobody is going to liken that to the Raf Simons Calvin Klein collection. So as long as you're able to, and you know, it's going to be very different than if you are going to go to a Calvin Klein store. That should be its own experience as well. If you're able to kind of create a distinct, consistent brand that makes sense in different product categories, different price points, then I don't think Amazon can successfully kill your brand, even if you do sell there.
Yeah, so I'm very curious to see if Nordstrom, Sephora, and others can provide a more friendly opportunity for those brands to be at retail, but that doesn't necessarily incorporate the online aspect because I just don't think Nordstrom is there currently. I mean, obviously compared to Amazon. The other area that we haven't talked about is the aggregators like, you know, List and Farfetch and those types of websites. I'm particularly fascinated with List, L-Y-S-T these days. I don't know if it's I think your team has written about it. I don't know if you have. The way they make money is obviously through affiliate links, but some of them do a much better job than Amazon even does at helping you filter and shop.
Right. I have questions about List as well. We recently did a story because LVMH invested a pretty big round of funding in the company, and I was, before that happened, I was kind of the mind that that business model was on its way out. Like I feel like you can only sustain like a viable business as such like a true blue middleman for so long because, you know, I think people eventually realize like, oh wait, there's really no, you know, need for this. I can search things myself, especially when you're just being sent to a different e-commerce site to shop. Like at least Farfetch, you can do it all there. It does feel like a retail experience. You might not really realize that they don't own all the inventory that they're selling. But for the most part, I think what it does show is that people do want inspiration and curation, which I think Amazon really hasn't been able to do. But I don't know. I think it just for the department stores that are and other online retailers that are having to compete against basically their own ad dollars as List is, you know, because it's an SEO game at the end of the day. I think it'd be really interesting. But what they do have is that customer data, which I think is people are willing to pay for, even if they know it's not a business that's going to be around forever.
Well, you know, I think it's an interesting thing. It's sort of a black hole to me because there's a bunch of platforms that follow that same. You could even count Pinterest in there, you know, which is in that category of inspiration. If you're someone who's just sort of curious about what should I wear or what should I buy? And you put in some keywords and it's hard to tell like how much that influences purchasing decisions. But I know for sure that it's just gotten so much harder to shop on Amazon and do any sort of like useful filtering because there are so many products that it's become impossible to shop on that platform for me at least. And so I don't know if that's a problem that they're even looking to solve at all.
I think they must be. Do you remember Amazon Spark?
What was that? I forget. No, what was that for? Like new like Kickstarter type of things.
It was like basically their own like social media platform interface, where you could like get to it on the homepage, and they were trying to get influencers to. It was like a very shoppable. It looked like Instagram. You would like post photos, but you could tag things that you could buy on Amazon right there.
Hmm.
I don't know if it's fully dead, but it never took off. So I think it kind of just goes to show, even if you're Amazon, you can't, like, I think people are really set in their ways when it comes to, one, like the social media that they're willing to use, and two, how they approach Amazon. Like, you type in sheets, and you look at the top ones that come up, and you kind of have to stay there, because you could really keep scrolling forever and just get confused and overwhelmed, and you know, that's just not a great user experience. And so I think that's why Amazon can be really nerve-wracking to brands, because that algorithm is so important. Like whatever is being promoted in the first page, like if you're any further, unless, you know, someone's looking for something very specific, you're really going to get lost there. And so it's interesting to see how they've approached that. They have like little perks for for areas that I think, and it shows where their interest is. So fashion is one. It kind of has a nicer homepage, but I don't really know how many people are actually even seeing that homepage. But if you're there, you're better off than if you're not there as a fashion brand. But they also have on the beauty side, like a luxury beauty little like shop and shop, as well as recently launching going to launch this month, a page for indie beauty brands specifically. And so I think that they're moving towards that, but I don't know. It's just...
Yeah, I'm just very curious about what do new brands do today. We've been talking about this on a meta level on a few different episodes. A few episodes ago, we had Helen Rice, who's the founder of Fuzzco, which is a design agency that works with a lot of these types of companies. A year ago, there was a really thought-provoking article on Racked that was titled, "Why Does Every Lifestyle Startup Look the Same?" I don't know if you remember seeing that one. But I think that we've come to a point now where there's a model that is very clear for how you can bring a new product online, cut out the middleman, use a bunch of stuff that you can kind of scotch tape together to create a brand and a product really quickly. And I'm just curious to see how far that can go, because on the top end, the ones that have been really successful are the ones that now need to find new ways to continue growing. On the low end, is it even possible anymore to gain that momentum because advertising has become so expensive? So I feel like we're in a very tumultuous time where the patterns that have worked in the past like 5 to 10 years that have led to the emergence of like really big direct-to-consumer brands may not be the ones that work for the next 10 years.
Right. It seems like we're tapped out on all the different, you know, I didn't see the exact item I wanted on the market, so I made it myself. Like, we've just heard that so often that I think it'd be really hard today, especially because you think on the investor side, I think investors have wisened up as well. So getting off the ground is a lot harder. I think when you go forward, you think about like, okay, how can you scale today? I think that one, being like a vertically integrated brand is going to be hugely beneficial. If you are able to own your entire supply chain, come out with a full range of sizes, like that's not going to be a problem to have to work with different factories and expand them. So owning your supply chain, which, you know, it's not an easy task, but I think that that's going to be a big leg up for brands going forward, as well as the recognizable founder story, the Instagram cult, basically, that people want to buy into. I think that's why we've seen people become so successful, and just having almost like a fuller lifestyle brand mindset from the beginning. Obviously, it comes down to product at the end of the day, and so you have to be able to support that story with good product. But I think that there's still room for brands that understand, one, how to sustainably grow business. It's you know, you can't build one off of expensive advertising alone. And so having that business logistics built in from the beginning, as well as someone who's really the face of the brand and is building something that people want to buy into, isn't tapped out yet. I think we've seen a lot of brands that want people to buy into, this is okay, a meaningful brand story. We are, you know, going to give you the luxury prices without the markup. There's no middleman. I don't think that people are connecting with that as much anymore. But I think what is going to be really interesting going forward is seeing how these brands decide to distribute. Like, are you going to open stores from the outset? What are those stores going to look like? And are you going to work with other retail partners? Because I think that, especially as we're seeing, it's harder to build a brand on its own. It's becoming more expensive. How are you going to, you know, gain scale and get exposure? I think that's going to end up back in the, you know, wholesale retail model. Maybe not wholesale. You could do like the shop and shop at a department store. But I think we are going to see some of these pillars that people built brands on in the past 10 years kind of shake out as brands need to find ways to grow while still building a meaningful brand that people are able to connect with. I think that the online only days are over. I think And I think that soon, like the no other outside retail partner days are going to be over too.
Yeah. The other one, and I think you sort of alluded to it a little bit, but just the idea of influencers, whether it's on YouTube or Instagram, getting enough momentum from the content that they're creating to then spin that into a brand seems like a thing that is definitely working. And there's been prototypes of that, like Glossier is a great example of that, but now it's become more of a template that other people are experimenting with. But the interesting thing about it is it has a natural ceiling. Eventually, I think what people get excited about with influencers and following people is that they can have a direct relationship with them, and that eventually hits a natural scale. Is it something where like the new talent agencies of the future, the like CAAs and WMEs of the future, will be like the place where like brands are being built and like commerce is happening? I'm curious to see.
Maybe. I mean, we've seen it the other way where the influencers that were just born online on Instagram and YouTube are not only building brands, but are building talent and production agencies. So it's crazy to think about it that way. But I think that as people have this very like influential platform, I think that could be where brands are born, as long as they're smart enough to hire the right people around them as to actually scale a brand, because I think that's a good signifier that a brand has the potential of taking off and succeeding, is if they know who to hire, people who have supply chain experience, people who have physical retail experience, and just plain old e-commerce experience, rather than, you know, trying to do it all themselves.
Yeah, maybe this is not a novel thought, but it kind of feels like you're either, like you said, a brand that really owns the full stack. You have your own supply chain, you're vertically integrated, you're building a product that's very differentiated and great and unique, and there's a certain, you know, group of people who love that. Or you're someone like an influencer where you're building this off of marketing and the product almost doesn't matter at all. It can be this very commoditized thing. You're basically just monetizing the influence that you've built. And anything in between is going to be really difficult to deal with.
Right. I think that there's so two thoughts. I think that one, I think we're going to see a lot of these brands working together. I think which we've had on the Glossy podcast, the models around like an assembled brands and a resonance where they're basically building like pseudo incubators, resources, platforms for these brands to be able to actually scale. I think we're going to see a lot of like glomming together of these smaller brands that, you know, it's expensive and it's hard to do it on your own as designers basically need to do more and more that distracts them from the main product. So I think that we're going to see more of that. But then also I feel like there's more space for like, what's like the modern, like trendy direct-to-consumer digitally native brand for non-millennials, whether that's right. Gen Z or older customers. You know, I think there's the number of brands that we've spoken to who describe their customer as an 18 to 34 year old woman. Like she can only buy so many clothes. So, you know, what about everyone else? I think that there's still a lot of room to appeal to those customers that aren't either end of that demographic, where, you know, I don't know exactly what that would look like, but that seems like there's still a lot of opportunity there. It's just the once people get over their millennial obsession, that maybe they'll see it too.
That's a great point. We could go on for hours. We're almost there already. So if people want to read more of your stuff, they can go to glossy.co as well as DigiDay, which what's the relationship between those two? DigiDay is like the parent company?
Yeah, so DigiDay Media is the parent company. Under that, we have DigiDay, Glossy, and Tearsheet, which is a financial tech publication. DigiDay covers media, modern media, and marketing. And so Glossy was spun out of that to focus specifically on fashion and beauty retail. And we will cross post stories if they align, because obviously we're covering modern marketing as well. I actually was on the DigiDay side as the retail reporter before we launched Glossy, so we all work pretty close together.
So you're full time on Glossy now, and the podcast as well, which is great. If people want more brands, more people talking about how they're building their businesses, anything else we should point people to?
The Amazon newsletter, that you can sign up for that on Digiday. That is just, I think, type in Digiday Amazon newsletter. I don't have the sign up.
We'll put the link in the show notes.
Yes, thank you.
Cool. Well, thank you so much, Hillary.
All right, great. Thank you. It was fun.
Thanks for listening. If you enjoyed the show, if you got something useful out of it, I would love to hear what that was. Consider writing a short review, could be just a sentence long, by going to iTunes and searching for Well Made. I want to hear it all. I want to hear good, bad. I want to hear your constructive criticisms. I am just trying to make this show as useful as possible for you. So tell us what you think. That is the very best way that you can support the show. Thanks, and see you next time.